The lecture for today is entitled Heroes and the Spirits of Ancestors. And you will see that this lecture relates not only to the reading that you've been doing in the first 16 scrolls of the Iliad, it will also fit beautifully, I think, with the film I'm going to be showing to you next Tuesday, exceptionally not at Boylston Auditorium, which is where we had the last screening. This one will be at the Harvard Film Archive, which is at the Carpenter Center. This is a rare treat because the Harvard Film Archive is one of the treasures of Harvard when it comes to an amazing collection of special films. And not only that, but their projection is impeccable and particular. Will you stop? This particular film, which is called The Double Life of Veronique, directed by Kieślowski, addresses, it's almost as if he had read my lecture notes, which he didn't, all the intellectual agenda that I'm going to cover today, except that the concept of the body double in Kieślowski's film is played out by a woman, not by a man. And as you can imagine in this course, which has such an emphasis on performance of song traditions, the way it's lived out is through song. This is an amazing film. Whether you've seen it or not, I hope you come and see it in all its cinematic glory. This will be, you know, standard screen projection, and I'm very eager. And what I think will happen is, if you hadn't gone to the Harvard Film Archive before, this will get you into habit, because it is an amazing resource for Harvard University. So do come at 8 o'clock. You notice that I had in number one of the lecture notes the name of Achilles' nearest and dearest friend, whose name is Patroclus, and the full Greek form of his name is Patrokles, which means he who has the kleos of the ancestors. So I think the name of Patroclus is already giving us a hint about why it's important to think about the spirits of the ancestors in today's lecture. Patroclus, number two, is the Theropon of Achilles. And we've seen in the previous lecture that this interesting word, Theropon, means something like ritual substitute. And in 2A, I muse a little bit about the glossary definitions, A, attendant, and B, ritual substitute. And I'm claiming for you that the word attendant is a very good translation when you're reading on the surface, and that ritual substitute is appropriate when you're reading underneath the surface. The key is that climactic moment when Patroclus, in Book 11, or Scroll 11 of the Iliad, is designated as Isos Arei, or equal to Ares. This expression, equal to Ares, is applied to Patroclus. So what I was saying is that Patroclus begins his fatal involvement in taking the place of Achilles, becoming Achilles' ritual substitute in a very unguarded moment. He's just in his tent, he's coming out of his tent, because Achilles calls him, Patroclus, would you come here? Who, me? Okay, he comes out of the tent, and at that point, because this is a performance medium, the language of Homeric poetry applies to him this radioactive epithet, Isos Arei, equal to Ares. And that, from that point on, is the beginning of his doom. And when you look up this passage in your Butler translation, you will see that the voice of the narrator actually says at this point, he came out equal to Ares, and that was the beginning of his doom. Ek molen isos arei kakudarahoi pelenarche. And you say to yourself, he's not doing anything, he's just coming out of the tent. But in terms of the overall narrative, that is the point at which his fatal involvement begins. And that is the point from which onwards it is inevitable that his fatal attraction with the divine antagonist of Achilles, who will become his own divine antagonist, Apollo, will happen. And we saw in 2b, I'm reviewing with you, that climactic moment in Scroll 16 where he finally comes face to face with Apollo And instead of backing down as he did the first time he did it in Scroll 16, the second time, he just goes after God face to face. And at that point, he's smitten and dies a ritual death, and in effect dies in place of Achilles. Been described as the most sacred moment of the Iliad. And at that point, he is called equal to a daimon. To see, a generic warrior is called a seraphon of Ares. Generically, the hero as warrior dies for Ares, but specifically, the hero dies in place of the god who is his personal ritual antagonist. And we've seen from the last time that both for Achilles and for his body double, Patroclus, the ritual antagonist is Apollo, the god who has long hair, who is beardless, who is in so many ways the look-alike, the fatal look-alike of Achilles. So, 2D, generically, Achilles would be the Seraphon of Ares, but specifically, he's the Seraphon of Apollo. And you might like to look at this source book page with the plot summary of the Song of the Ethiopians, the Ithiopis. Eat your hearts out. This particular plot summary is just a plot summary from the ancient world. We don't have the actual epic, but at least we know the plot line. And you can actually see from that plot line how Achilles himself will die at a later point, off stage from the Iliad. And I can tell you that if we had this epic, it would be a dead ringer for the way Patroclus dies in Scroll 16. You may say that the death of Patroclus in Scroll 16 is a rehearsal, a dress rehearsal, hint, hint, for the death of Achilles off stage. 2F, Patroclus must die for Achilles. Achilles must die for Apollo. Now, at that moment when Patroclus dies, as I explore it with you in number 3 of the notes, he is in a specially revved up mental state. When he is equal to the daimon, he is, if you use an Old Norse analogy, berserk. He's in a state of being berserk. And if you study Irish mythology, you call this state, people in the trade call it, warp spasm. I like warp spasm because when we saw Blade Runner, I thought that Roy came very close to warp spasm at the very end of the narrative. In Old Irish narrative, when you have a warp spasm, you not only get angry, when the blood rushes to your head is ready to explode and your head gets redder and redder and redder. And then the blood just keeps wanting to go someplace so it starts forcing itself up through your hair follicles. And next thing you know, there's a shock of red hair. And next thing you know, one of your eyeballs may be as big as a pumpkin, the other may be as small as a pin. Nice example of expansion and compression, you know. But the point is, in all sorts of different song cultures, there are different ways of expressing the holy dread of what a warrior is like when he meets death face to face. One thing I loved about the film we saw on Tuesday, When We Were Kings, is how Muhammad Ali describes his own state of being when he is ready to fight, and how he kind of rouses himself to a very special state of fury. Number 4, the ritual background for this word seraphon. Basically, if you look at older civilizations from which this word had been borrowed from the Greeks, by the Greeks, in these older civilizations, the idea is that the king of a community, and we'll see later in the course that the king is the embodiment of society, the king has to die for the whole society on a seasonally recurring basis. And instead of the king's dying, it's politically practical to have the person who is closest to the king, most identical to the king, to die in the king's place. And that person would then be the ritual substitute. And guess what happens? When that person dies on a seasonally recurring basis every year in place of the king, essentially the community as a whole is cured, because the king is the body politic. The king is the embodiment of society. So if the king dies for the community, even by proxy, that means the community is healed. And that's the concept, as we see in number 5, of le transfert du mal, the transfer of evil. That all the things that are wrong with society, and therefore are embodied in the king, can be purified if the king dies, or somebody dies for the king, and that somebody who dies for the king will be a sacrificial victim. Now, don't look at your notes for a minute. Just look at me. You see this, think of this word therapon. Suppose I tell you that it has a relative in English, which is therapeutic. You can see that therapy and therapeutic have to do with the social aspect of ridding the community or ridding the individual of all the ills that inflict the community or the individual. Of breaking free from the pollution. I'm trying to say this in as many ways as possible. Now, there's a very interesting Greek word, don't look at your notes, which is pharmakos, which gives us the word pharmacy, pharmaceutical, etc. And the noun form of this word, the neuter noun form, means drug, cure, medicine. And that's how we get pharmacy and so on, pharmacologist. But there's another word, pharmakos, which is the name of a person. And every time I ask people, well, what do you think Greek pharmakos means? They think it means somebody who dispenses drugs, somebody who dispenses a cure, maybe a physician, etc., etc., etc. But you know what? Pharmakos means scapegoat. That is to say, somebody who is sacrificed in place of the entire community, so that the entire community can be free of pollution. So now you can look back at your notes. Number 7, there you see therapeo, meaning heal, cure. And then number 8, I just repeat what I just did for you, but I didn't want you to be looking at it while you were thinking about what pharmakos could possibly mean. Now, one of the most interesting philosophers who has dealt with this problem of the transfer of evil, or to use the French expression as we see in number 5, le transfert du mal, is the French existential philosopher Simone Weil, number 9 in the handout, who writes, the wish to see others suffer exactly what we are suffering, that is evil. What an interesting definition of evil, where you've already suffered, and let's say you've suffered a lot, and then you have this conceived desire within yourself for somebody else to suffer just the way you suffered. I want him to suffer exactly the way I've suffered. Okay? For Simone Weil, this is quintessential evil, because what you're doing is you're transferring the evil that you experience to somebody else. And you know what's most evil about it? What's most evil about it is that the more you want somebody else to suffer exactly the way you do, the more they suffer differently. Everybody has their own different way of suffering. And that's what's evil about passing it on. And for Simone Weil, the definition of an existential hero is somebody who, this is not a Greek definition, this is Simone Weil's definition. An existential hero is somebody who does not pass it on, who does not pass on the suffering, but instead, are you ready, absorbs it all herself or himself. And in the process dies for the community, so to speak. And it's hard to be objective about the life of Simone Weil, but she was a very confused person when it came to figuring out who she belonged to, because she was Jewish, she was Catholic, she was also a top-notch philosopher, which was at odds with her religion. She was conflicted in many ways, but the horrors of World War II afflicted her so badly that by the time World War II was over, her nervous system couldn't stand it anymore, and she essentially, I hope I'm not misrepresenting, starved herself to death. So it's one of the saddest ends of a philosopher, but when you think about some of the things she writes, and I leave for you some of her other wonderful observations in the handout, and I hope you do read them, you will see that this has a great deal to do with our agenda today, which is, why is it that Patroclus essentially absorbs all the ills of the society of the Achaeans and essentially dies in their place, thereby making the community well again, and more specifically dies in place of the king who had sat it out in the war, that's Achilles up to this point, dies for him. Number 11, once Patroclus dies, Achilles becomes a man of constant sorrow. He is grieving for his friend, and the friend is so near and dear to him that he grieves for himself. So every time you see Achilles crying after book 16, he's already crying for himself. When you see Thetis, his mother, crying for him in the Song of Lament in scroll 18, which we looked at the other day, she is crying for Achilles because Achilles is as good as dead, since Patroclus, his nearest and dearest friend, is already dead. And in section this week, your section leaders showed you a piece of micro-narrative in book 9 that I think illustrates beautifully what Patroclus and the spirit of the ancestors is all about, and why it is that he, of all people, is the nearest and dearest to Achilles. How did we do it in section? We did it by looking at the micro-narrative, the story told by the old man Phoenix to Achilles, which was supposed to be a story that points Achilles to how he's supposed to behave in his story, in his own song, where the micro-narrative helps Achilles understand what his macro-narrative is about, and helps us as well finally understand what is really at stake, what are the big issues of the Iliad. A beautiful example of how compression helps us understand expansion, and vice versa. And what I would like to focus as we finish this week and finish our work in sections and work in lectures is the ascending scale of affection that I summarized for you in number 13. And in the Greek language, and in Greek culture, one way to express what an individual's ascending scale of affection is simply to follow a logical narrative sequence, to mention, let's say, person one, person two, person three, in the ascending order of how close they are to the person that we're talking about, in this case, Meleager. And so we see in number 13 that Meleager loves the elders, but he loves the priests more, and he loves his father more, and he loves his sisters more, he loves his mother more, he loves his comrades or companions even more. Obviously, that's where the old man wanted the story to end, in his micro-narrative. After all, the old man is a companion, just as these companions in his story are Philoi, so also the delegates, Phoenix, Odysseus, and Ajax are companions as well. But then what's so fascinating is the story goes out of control. Or should I say, the micro-narrative goes out of control. The macro-narrative stays right on track. And how does the micro-narrative go out of control? Because Phoenix's own agenda about what he wants to prove to Achilles are undercut by what happens in the logic of the story. After the comrades or companions at arms are mentioned, who in Phoenix's terms would be the top of the ascending scale of affection, the bedroom in which Meleager is staying receives a direct hit. Now we know suddenly that he has his wife next to him in the bedroom. And what does the wife do? She starts wailing, crying, and as we already know in this song culture, crying and singing go together. The song is not about an individual death, it's the death about a whole community, which is a special form of Greek lament. A form of Greek lament that makes people even more sad and grieving than if it's an individual's death. Here's the holocaust of the whole society. The men are killed, the children are killed, and the women are led off into a life of sexual degradation. That is what she is singing about. And at that point, what happens to Meleager? He feels this intense grief. We've talked about this. and then the grief metastasizes to a red hot fury, a berserk anger, and then he finally goes back to war. But in that case, in a sense, the intention of Phoenix in telling the story, we're at the top of the ascending scale of affection for the story within a story, for Meleager in the story, where the comrades, is undercut, because the logic of the story tells us there's somebody who's even higher up in Meleager's ascending scale of affection, who's even closer to Meleager, and that's his wife. And look at the name of the wife, number 14, Cleopatra. What does that mean? She who has the glory of the ancestors. What does Patroclus mean? He who has the glory of the ancestors. Well then, for heaven's sake, what is the micro-narrative telling Achilles? Is it really telling him to stop sitting out the war right then and there? Is it really telling him to join his companions in arms? No, because there seems to be somebody who's higher up in his ascending scale of affection. He may not know it yet, but in a sense, the name Cleopatra is already coding what will be the ultimate outcome of the macro narrative. But then you ask yourself, who really is dearest to Achilles? Is it really Patroclus, his nearest and dearest friend? Or is it the concept that is behind the name of Patroclus, the glory of the ancestors? And I suggest to you, if you look at number 16, where Achilles himself says, I'm going to give up my life, but in return for my life, I will have a kleos that is unwilting, like a beautiful flower that never loses its color, never loses its aroma, that will be beautiful forever and ever. In that case, you see how we've taken the agenda of the micro-narrative even further. Now this question of who exactly Patroclus is to Achilles has been treated by the Greeks themselves on all sorts of levels. You can say it in terms of friendship, but you can even say it, I think you can even say it in terms of sexuality. And a lot of students have asked me in the past whether Achilles and Patroclus have a homosexual relationship. Well, I don't like to say that word because that's too late 20th century, but I will answer that in the 5th century, in Athenian tragedy, yes. In tragedy, which is a medium that's later than what we're reading, they did have, in that version, a homoerotic relationship. But as far as the Iliad is concerned, it's not that homosexuality is taboo, because it isn't, but it's tied in with all sorts of social customs that we're not yet ready to examine, and we will examine later. So I'd like to give the answer that the relationship between Achilles and Patroclus is more intimate than sexual, because what really bonds them together is that one man is actually willing to die for the other man, and that in this song culture, the willingness to die for somebody else is considered more intimate than sex itself. Okay? And I think we can stay on that level for the time being. Except that I want to add to that, that we can't just look at it on an individualistic basis, because, in a sense, Achilles not only has Patroclus die for him, by way of this death, Patroclus dies for the whole community as well, and we can't separate the individual from the community in this particular ritual death. Remember how I told you the last time that the actual death of Patroclus was like the death of a sacrificial bull? Think back about Simone Weil and her definition of the existential hero, somebody who sacrifices himself or herself in order to stop the passing on of evil from one sufferer to the other, passing on of suffering from one person to another. Whoever absorbs it all and stops the chain of evil, le transfert du mal, is the existential hero. Now this theme, I hope I've made it abundantly clear in the last two lectures, is not only a theme of epic, it's a theme of lyric, a theme of lament songs and love songs. And as I suggested to you the last time, love songs can dwell on this idea of people dying for others, of all sorts of things going wrong. And you remember I I was already very interested, and I come back to it here in number 19, in Sappho 31, where you have a female first person, I, talking to a female second person, you, about a male third person, he. So, the I is she, you is she, and the he is the third person, the subject. And there's a lot of eroticism going on here, but we can't really appreciate it if we can't understand, and this is what I'm driving home yet again, that the kind of person that this sexy bridegroom is exactly the kind of person that the entire Greek song culture imagined Achilles to be, that Achilles was the number one doomed bridegroom, and that this love song topic, not just an epic topic, would drive people crazy. So I'm thinking to myself, how do I illustrate to students the dynamics of this very interesting wedding song, where there are three parties involved, two women and one man. There are all sorts of erotic signals going in all sorts of directions, and where the ending, look at the ending. A little short of death do I appear to me. You see that? In other words, after all the sensuality and all the description of the way she feels, and I described it the other day in terms of Madonna's song, Like a Prayer, you know, all this sensual feeling then climaxes in the female speaker, the I, saying, a little short of death do I seem to myself. Well, the English translation seem is tricky, because if you look back at the beginning of the song, where the bridegroom is being described as a god, the word seem there is like what we call in religious history today an epiphany. It's where a sacred something appears and where you're dazzled by the brilliance. And what's very weird about the ending of this song is there's an auto-epiphany, so to speak, of death. It's almost auto-erotic, but it's definitely auto-epiphany, because in the culmination of all these sensual feelings, all these physical and mental feelings and emotional feelings, she says, I'm at the cusp of death. I'm going to die right now. And of course, again, you think of a lament and love song, preoccupation with grief over death, preoccupation with love and sexuality. In this tradition, in an uncanny way, these things can keep coming together. So how am I going to represent this? This may not work. And Yancy, are you there? Is Yancy there? Yeah. I'm going to try this on you, and it probably won't work, but because it's a very bad video, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I copied it off a TV series directed by David Lynch, and it's in the series called Twin Peaks. And basically you have a boy called James singing a love song to two girls. And just watch the eye contact. In Greek civilization, you really have to watch the eye contact, because that tells you who's signaling to whom. Look at the way the eye contact go in all sorts of different directions. But get this, the song is, he's singing this to the two of them, just you and I together, just you and I together, forever in love. You say, wait a minute, he's singing this to two people, yet he's saying, just you and I together. So that already is an explosive situation. Just watch how the eye contacts work as he's doing it. Why does he say forever? And why does David Lynch have James, the secret boyfriend of Laura Palmer, sing this song with the voice of a woman? You'll see that James isn't really singing it. It's dubbed, and it's David Lynch's favorite singer, Angelo Badalamenti's favorite singer, and it's a woman's voice singing as the man lip syncs it. So I hope that gives you plenty to think about as we see this very short clip.
That was really good. Let's try it again. Thank you. Donna. What's wrong?
Nothing.
Donna. Donna, what's going on? Donna.
Yes?
There's a telephone call for you from a Harold Smith.
That was bad. Well, I seriously, I would like for you to reread sample 31 after that and just see what kind of tension is being developed there. But now to be serious about it, the song of Sappho with this conjuring of the perfect bridegroom, and we've already seen that the perfect bridegroom can be a doomed bridegroom, is part of Sappho's overall repertoire of looking at unrequited love, of looking at doomed love, of looking at horrible endings to stories, and including the story of the Iliad. And in number 17, I draw your attention to the fact that in this particular composition, which is like a female epic, the two chief characters are Hector and Andromache, who become the victims of Achilles. And they are described as equal to the gods. So in the same kind of ritual antagonism way that Achilles and Patroclus are described in the Iliad, so that we cannot separate this kind of love story theme with the themes of the epic. And vice versa, when people listen to the Iliad, they're always thinking about characters like this singer, for example, because Achilles is the number one singer as well as the number one subject of both epic and love story. That's the message that we have to understand so that we can relate to this central figure of the Iliad in terms of the Greek song culture, not only in terms of the Iliad, which only gives us this one dimension. The way I wanted to underline this in yet another way is to show you a clip from the film we're going to see next week, The Double Life of Veronique. And I have to give you some background for it so that we can appreciate what's going on here. It's not really giving away the plot of the story to say that there are two identical women who grow up in two different parts of the world. One of them grows up under very difficult circumstances in Poland in the days of the Solidarity Movement. The other one grows up in France, a much more comfortable and easy existence. As I say, they're body doubles. That's the premise of the story. And they're both extremely talented musicians, specifically singers. But they've both been told that they have a heart condition, a potentially fatal heart condition. And if they strain their voice too much in a moment of musical exertion, what will happen is they will have a rupture of the aorta and they will die. Okay? And so the French woman becomes a music teacher. The Polish woman decides to go on and gets the big break and is going to be appearing as the diva, I can say now diva, at this performance. And it's one of the best ways for me to illustrate the whole concept of god-hero antagonism, of ritual substitution, because these are the things that Kieślowski, the filmmaker, is interested in. But it gets better, which is that what the woman will be singing when her great moment in the sun comes, when she's going to be singing in the concert, is a very interesting piece of music where the words of Dante, and I give them to you in number 20 of the handout, the words of Dante are set to music. And here in this passage, if you look at the Dante passage, I translate it, it says, "Oh, you out there inside your tiny little barge, eager to listen, following behind my ship, that singing crosses to deep seas. Don't set out into the deep for fear that perhaps losing sight of me, you be set adrift. The waters that I sail were never crossed before. Athena, the goddess, inspires me. Apollo is my helmsman, and the nine muses show me the bear star." justice it was that set in motion the high artisan who made me. It was the divine power, the highest wisdom, and primal love. To hear again this idea of expression of love as being basic for lyric, for song in general. Here is somebody talking to the uninitiated. She's already initiated. She dares to go into the deep waters. Why? Because look at the title of this particular part of Dante's composition, Verso il Cielo. She's headed for the sky. Well, she's looking towards the sky. This is an amazing moment where everything comes together. And it's the kind of holy dread that we see when we get to the climax of Iliad Scroll 16, when Patroclus finally meets the god face to face. You remember how Muhammad Ali says at one point, or was it the commentator, something about meeting the eyes of God or something at the climax of one's ordeal as an athlete? This is the kind of ordeal we have, but it's a musical moment, except that the musical moment is life and death, as in the world of heroes. So in this clip that I'm going to show you, first you have a setup, which is what these two women were like as little girls, and they're both orphans, their mother had died, and one of them looks to the earth, and the other looks to the sky. Okay, and you can guess which one looks to the sky, which one looks to the earth. And then right after that, I'll show you the clip, immediately after that, the clip of where Veronika, the Polish body double, has her big moment on the concert stage, and then what exactly happens. And what I'd like you to look for is what the last shot is. In other words, whose perspective does the camera angle take at the very last moment of this clip? After the clip is over, I want to read what I think is a very good closure for how the ancient Greeks looked at the spirits of the ancestors through such figures as Patroclus and through such climactic moments. But Yancy, if we could play both of the clips, one after the other.
To jest gwiazdka, na którą czekaliśmy, żeby zacząć wigilię. Widzisz? A tam, niżej, jest taka mgła. Popatrz. To nie jest mgła. To są miliony małych gwiazdek. Pokaż. Voici la première feuille. C'est le printemps. Et sur tous les arbres, il va y avoir des feuilles. Regarde. Ici, sur le côté plus clair, il y a comme des petites veines et le sujet très fin.
Thank you. neither yet.
You know what her last words are? Don't set out into the deep for fear that, perhaps, losing sight of me, you'd be left adrift. So it's at the actual moment of initiation. I want to end by thinking about the spirits of the ancestors and reading from an ancient Greek source about why people worship gods. It will just take two sentences. The idea is that you're insomniac, and for no reason that you can figure out, you reach out your arms. Who do you reach out your arms to? To your parents. And that is the fundamental impulse to worship. Here's the way the ancient Greek source says it. Through their longing for the divine, all people have a powerful urge to worship and serve the deity from nearby. Like children that have been taken away from their father and mother, they're filled with a strange longing, and often in their dreams reach out their hands to their parents who are not there. So too do people in their love for the gods seek, and properly so because of their benefits and affinity, in all possible ways to be with the gods and in their company. We'll see you next week. Thank you.